From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There have been many books written about the financial recession of 2008 and the housing mortgage crisis that caused so many Americans to lose their homes. But what happened after the crash? A new book exposes how hedge fund investors and Wall Street executives took advantage of the housing crash and swooped in with government backing to scoop up hundreds of thousands of homes and rent them back to the public. That phenomenon was not just a massive transfer of wealth from ordinary Americans to the wealthy and powerful, but it also led to the lowest levels of home ownership in decades. In a country that prides itself on individuals owning property as a form of wealth creation. Many of the villains in that story, whom my guest calls homewreckers, are today part of Donald Trump's administration. Aaron Glantz now joins me. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, a two-time Peabody Award winner, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, PBS NewsHour, and more. And he joins me to discuss his new book, Homewreckers, how a gang of Wall Street kingpins, hedge fund magnates, crooked banks, and vulture capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
It's good to be with you.
I should say you were a one-time colleague of mine working at KPFA Pacifica Radio, and I'm very proud of everything that you've achieved since you've left Pacifica. So this book is, of course, not only quite remarkable to read, it's also very tragic. And you start out telling the story of your own home and how you came to purchase your very first home. Tell us that story and how, in a way, that was quite atypical of what happened after the crash.
Yeah, in 2009, I bought a house that I'm sitting in right now, actually, in the western side of San Francisco. It's not that big. It's 1,000 square feet. But anyone who knows anything about real estate in California knows what a blessing it is to have the opportunity to buy a house in San Francisco. And I had grown up here. And I had always felt that there was no chance that I would ever be able to own a house like my parents in the city that I grew up in. But then with the crash, it was like San Francisco was having a 50% off sale, right? There were foreclosures all over the place. And suddenly there's this house up on a hill that fell into my price range. And my parents helped and my wife's parents helped with the down payment. And now for the last 10 years, we've been living here. With our, you know, fixed rate mortgage payment that doesn't go up, and every month we own a little bit more of our house. And as I look around, with gentrification and displacement being the bywords of the day, my colleagues and friends who rent constantly worry that their rent is going up and will they have to leave the region. I'm sitting here with a measure of comfort in knowing that I own my own home, and. You know, I wondered as an investigative reporter why more people weren't able to have this positive experience that I had. You know, you mentioned in your intro that the home ownership rate in 2016 hit a 50-year low. So that means that the home ownership rate didn't just go down during the housing bust years of 2008, 2009, 2010. It kept going down even during the supposed economic recovery in 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, and then bottomed out in 2016. So if there were other families like mine that were buying foreclosures and living in them, the home ownership rate would have remained stable. But instead, it kept going down. So what I wanted to know was what happened to all of these 8 million homes, including 1 million here in California that were lost to foreclosure. And that was the beginning of the investigation that led to the book Homewreckers.
So, as you said, when the housing crash hit, home values dropped dramatically, of course, which ought to have then put them in the price range of Americans who couldn't afford them, maybe even Americans who had just lost their homes, you know, who might now be able to either rebuy their homes or buy other homes because the values had dropped. Instead, capitalists, as you call them, vulture capitalists, hedge fund investors, et cetera, swooped in and bought them up. How did that happen? Is it just that they were faster or had cash on hand? What enabled them to scoop up these homes over America, just ordinary individuals?
Well, I mean, part of it was that they were fast and they did have cash and they are rich. But that is not the whole story, right? And it can seem super complicated at times, which is why I thought it was appropriate to write a whole book about it. And what I try to do in the book is follow some individual homes that by following the homes, you kind of better understand these broad dynamics that were keeping housing out of reach for everyone. And I actually start out not even talking about homes at all, but about a bank based in Pasadena called IndyMac Bank, which was one of the biggest failures of the Great Recession. It failed in July 2008. Maybe some people might remember it because there were literal lines of depositors around the block. It was a bank collapse like we used to see in the Great Depression. And out of that, the government, in the form of the FDIC, the federal government, ended owning this bank, and they were looking for someone to buy it. And the person they sold it to was this former Goldman Sachs banker named Steve Mnuchin, who may be familiar to some of your listeners and viewers because he's now Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. Now, when the government sold this bank to Steve Mnuchin, including all of the loans on hundreds of thousands of homes all across this country, he didn't pay very much money. In fact, he paid nothing. So the group that he put together, which included George Soros and John Paulson and Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, the government was so eager to get rid of this bank that it sold it to Mnuchin's group for nothing. And then they did something else. They subsidized him as he made foreclosures on families. And so basically, if he foreclosed on a family and lost money, then the government would pay him for up to 90% of his losses. And so we, the taxpayers, end up subsidizing Mnuchin and his group to the tune of more than $1 billion as he forecloses on 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors. And many of them were in Southern California. And that's kind of like how I start the story, talking about a few houses that were caught up in this mess.
So this is when you say the government subsidized them. We're talking about the Obama administration at that time, right?
Yeah, this is all happening when Obama was president. So as I go through the book and all of the home wreckers that I discuss, not only Steve Mnuchin, who I mentioned, but also Wilbur Ross, who's now the Commerce Secretary, who made a similar deal to the one that I just described, but involving a bank in Florida. Donald Trump's closest friend, Tom Barrack, who organized the inauguration and introduced Ivanka at the Republican National Convention. His company bought up more than 30,000 homes across the country after they had been foreclosed. Steve Schwartzman, another good friend of the president, a billionaire worth about $15 billion, the co-founder of Blackstone, whose company now owns 80,000 single-family homes across more than a dozen states. All of this activity occurred during the Obama years. And then around 2016, when Donald Trump is running for president, and the rest of the smart Wall Street money, remember, was on Hillary, these guys start to coalesce around this renegade billionaire populist from Manhattan named Donald Trump. And then once he gets elected, they then go into power themselves, making rules that impact the rest of us.
And I want to get to how they're trying to deregulate our laws so that they can continue this sort of pillage. But before we do that, staying on how it was that they, under the Obama administration, scooped up these homes with government subsidies, wasn't the Obama administration also making it easier for individuals to buy homes? Wasn't that part of the recovery?
I mean, there were some programs that were designed to help individuals. I mean, for example, when we bought our house, we got an $8,000 first-time home buyer tax credit. That was one of the programs that was part of the economic stimulus package. There was also a part of the bank bailout called the Home. It was called HAMP, was the acronym, basically a mortgage modification program to help you renegotiate their loan. Consumers ended up really, really frustrated with that because it was voluntary for the banks to participate in, and it was very difficult to access. So you had this, you know, situation where a program for the people, the public, to access is voluntary and cumbersome, and people have trouble. And then on the other hand, the government is just shoveling money at a relatively small group of Wall Street types. And, you know, this continued not only during the bust itself. I mean, a lot of people say, like, well, Aaron, the economy was in a disastrous shape in 2008. People can be forgiven for acting rashly. But it continued for years. So by 2011, the government ends up as the owner of over 200,000 homes across the country because we were backing up these mortgages. They were foreclosed, so they end up in our hands. And then rather than trying to sell them off to one family at a time to stabilize the market while helping, you know, ordinary Americans build wealth, what they did was they bundled them together in bundles of more than 1,000 homes at a time, or up to 1,000 homes at a time, and they sold them off to big Wall Street hedge fund firms, including Tom Barracks, for just pennies on the dollar. And so it was deemed too complicated, you know, to sell them off to families, but not problematic at all to sell them 1,000 at a time at a deep discount to Wall Street types.
What you just said, I imagine, is causing such a rage among our viewers as it is causing me, just to think about how our own government that's supposed to represent us just violated Americans' abilities to own their own homes. Let's sort of, and then of course, just even getting new mortgages became hard as well, right? Because first it was too easy to get a mortgage, and that ended up helping to cause the mortgage crisis. But then, instead of, you know, making it a fair process, didn't it also become way harder for Americans who should have gotten mortgages to buy their first or second homes to actually get them?
Well, I mean, one of the home wreckers I discussed in the book is Jamie Dimon, who's the president and chief of J.P. Morgan Chase, which is the biggest bank in America by assets, which benefited hugely from government support during the housing bust. The government helped him acquire Washington Mutual, which was another failed bank, which allowed him to massively expand his operations to the West Coast, where Chase had not really been before. And after he did that, after we facilitated this, Chase dramatically scaled back its lending to everyday families, you know. And if you look at the mortgage lending that was being made by America's biggest bank, it didn't just go up during the bust. It continued to go down. And the Chase's mortgage lending in 2016 was far below its mortgage lending in 2010. So it was getting harder and harder to get a loan from this big bank if you wanted to buy a house. On the other hand, Chase was lending to these big Wall Street firms. And one of the things that I discuss in the book is the growth of these new mortgage-backed securities. So many of your listeners and viewers may remember that before the bust, what banks would do is, you know, bundle together a whole bunch of mortgages and put them into these gigantic loans and then cut the loans up and sell them on Wall Street. And so then when the housing market started to soften, nobody knew who owned any particular loan, and the entire, you know, economy collapsed. And what Chase is funding now is a new type of mortgage-backed security, but not on individual home loans, but on properties owned by this new class of corporate landlords that I was discussing. So one of the houses that I follow in the book was owned by this woman, Sandy Jolly, and her family had owned it for more than 30 years. Her father worked for the water department out in Ventura County. Her mother helped work at a company that made business and payroll checks. And after their home was foreclosed on and it was sold to Tom Barrack's company, and Sandy ends up paying $42,000 in rent over an 18-month period to continue to live in a home that her parents bought for less than $90,000 back in the 80s. After she moved out, the house is still owned by this Wall Street firm, and they are charging increasing amounts of rent. And as the property values go up, they go back again and again to banks like Chase to leverage it into bigger and bigger mortgage-backed securities, to the point where now, if you go look at the property record for her house at 681 Benson Way in Thousand Oaks, California, this 1,500-square-foot house with three bedrooms and two bathrooms and a little lawn and a lemon tree out front, you will see a $960 million lien against this little house. It's just, the first time I saw one of these, I could not believe it. But they are becoming more and more common as these properties go into bigger and bigger corporate ownership and bundled more and more. And just like, you know, individual families might have been pulling money out of their house to send their kids to college or fix their roof or remodel their kitchen or deal with a medical bill. These Wall Street firms are pulling billions out in equity, and they don't see a problem with it, and neither do the bond rating agencies that are trying to decide if these bundles are a good bet for investors, because they have tenants in there paying these off, right? Hmm. Paying more and more rent every month to pay out these gigantic bundles of debt that are being taken out against these homes and traded on Wall Street.
Aaron, let's step back and just talk about the importance of home ownership. I mean, of course, there are plenty of people who rent or choose to rent and have always rented because of various reasons. But in general, historically, as you describe in your book, this has been a country that has promoted home ownership. And it's done so because owning a home can actually be one of the few things that helps you create wealth at a rate much faster than just your salary, right? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the average American homeowner is worth $200,000. And this is 100 times more than the average renter. The average renter in America is worth only $2,000. And this is not because homeowners make 100 times more than renters. I mean, I'm a homeowner and I sit next to people at work who make basically the same salary as me, right? But their money is going to their landlord every month and mine is going into equity in my home, right? And what we see is that for most Americans are living in a paycheck to paycheck situation. The average American has only $4,000 in the bank. And if most of the money you're spending is on housing, shelter, food, clothing, transportation, healthcare, then housing is the only one of these major expenses where you have the ability to spend money and save at the same time. So either you're going to be saving money for yourself by paying off your mortgage, or you're going to be building equity and wealth for your landlord by paying rent. And that's why historically, as you mentioned, at least since the 1930s, the government has played a very active role in promoting homeownership. And now we see, you know, that deteriorating with these home wreckers in charge in Washington.
And of course, the home wreckers have invested in the homes of Americans because they're a great investment. You buy them up at a bargain with the help of the government, and then you have rent coming in to help you pay off those homes, and you just keep ratcheting up that rent. It becomes this near endless source of income for these people, right?
I mean, that is correct. And another thing that I write about in the book is how these corporate landlords make lease agreements with their tenants that put more and more of the cost of living in the home onto the tenant. Hmm. So the standard lease agreement that Sandy Jolly signed to stay in her home on, in Thousand Oaks, the lease said that if the plumbing burst, she would have to fix it. If the window broke, she would have to fix it. These are things that might be traditionally done by a landlord, but these companies are taking greater and greater control of the market. They have incredible market power. Our housing shortage is very acute. People feel like they have few options. And so not only are they charging more and more rent, but they're pushing more of the costs onto the tenant. Without the, if I fix my plumbing as a homeowner, well, then I get the benefit of the increased property value. In this case, they push the maintenance responsibility onto the tenant, but then they get the benefit of the increased property value.
That's incredible. Let's talk about how the phenomenon of the last decade and a half has also exacerbated the racial inequities in home ownership. Housing and racial discrimination have always been an American phenomenon. People of color, in particular Black Americans, have always been pushed out of the housing market, have had a harder time getting home loans and becoming homeowners. In the period of time that your book examines, did that trend continue?
Yeah, we live in a society today where the African-American home ownership rate is lower than it was when segregation was legal and discrimination was legal. It is lower now. Only about 4 in 10 African-American families own homes. That's worse than the Jim Crow era. And that is because of the actions that took place over the last decade, which I document in the book. So we had banks like Steve Mnuchin's that concentrated their foreclosures in communities of color. Here in California, Steve Mnuchin's One West Bank, they made about 70% of their foreclosures in communities of color. At the same time, when it came to making loans to families to help them buy homes, this bank, which is headquartered in LA, made over 5 years when Steve Mnuchin was in charge, only 3 loans to African-American families to help them buy homes, and only 11 to Hispanic families. So, you know, they are dispossessing people of color of their homes. And then you might argue, well, maybe those particular families just were not responsible. Well, they are totally unable, it seems, to find other families would be families of color that could help buy homes. And if you look at the pattern and practice of this bank, and you map the branches, it's almost like an old redlining map where the branches kind of assiduously avoid any neighborhoods of color in Southern California. And so this, you know, Steve Mnuchin, who ran this bank, he is now the Treasury Secretary in charge of regulating every American bank.
So let's talk about what it is that these home wreckers, as you've called them, many of whom are now in the Trump administration, are doing to ensure that they can continue wrecking the American dream.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been talking about Steve Mnuchin, who's the Treasury Secretary, which brings us to tax policy. Right. And most of your listeners and viewers are probably aware of the tax bill that President Trump signed and the fact that in general, it was a big, big gift to the rich. But there were some special goodies in there, specifically for the home wreckers. So, for example, you know, you and I, Sonali, as we're people who get paid a salary to work, we are taxed at basically at the rate of our income. Right. How more money we make, the more taxes we pay. The home wreckers, people who own property through LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies, and there are now over 3 million homes and 15 million apartment units in the U.S. that are owned by shell companies, they get to take now, because of the tax bill, a 20% tax deduction just straight off the top. And this is just one of a number of changes that were made to kind of make life easier for corporate landlords and a little bit harder for the rest of us. So, you know, that's what they did to help people who own properties through shell companies. How did they pay for it? By making it so you can no longer deduct the full value of your state and local property tax, right? By making it so that the mortgage interest deduction is capped. So if you're like an average family trying to buy a home, and you're asking, like, can I afford it? Now you're looking at, you know, a slightly less generous tax policy. But if you're a corporate landlord trying to buy 1,000 homes, you're looking at a much more generous tax policy. That's just on money. We talked about racial discrimination. Steve Mnuchin and the Treasury Department have been working very, very hard to change the way that the Community Reinvestment Act is enforced. This is a 1977 law meant to prevent redlining that says that banks have to invest in low-income communities and working-class communities. And, you know, it's all a lot of jargon, but basically at the end of the day, they're making it weaker. For example, you may start seeing fewer bank branches in low and working class communities. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was set up to protect us from these home wreckers, is being defanged. The Fair Housing Act, which banned discrimination, which was signed by President Johnson within days of Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, the terms of that are being changed. So you just go down the list, you know, and while so many of our commentators and our media are focusing on whatever the latest scandal is in the Trump administration, these guys are quietly working away, changing all the rules in a way that will really disadvantage us tremendously.
And of course, that is one of the many reasons that they tolerate Trump and protect his position, regardless of how he may be assaulting the Constitution. Aaron, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for the work you've done. Good luck with the book.
Okay, thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's a two-time Peabody Award winner and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We've been discussing his new book, Home Wreckers, how a gang of Wall Street kingpins, hedge fund magnates, crooked banks, and vulture capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you.